Facebook, Google, all of these companies are trying to figure out where are the rules and where are they going to draw the line.
There's clearly a demand for renters. They've got most of them full.
If you own a bond in your retirement portfolio, the price of that is going to go down.
This is the Wintrust Business Lunch, sponsored by Wintrust, Chicago's bank, on 720 WGN.
And here we are on Thursday afternoon, Steve Bertrand in the Allstate Skyline Studio. Welcome to the Biz Lunch. We talk a lot about student debt on this program, and Jillian Berman from MarketWatch will be along a little bit later in the second half hour to talk about how more and more high school students are actually earning college credits while they're in high school. The idea is it will save them money on tuition down the road. It's not clear it always does. We'll talk to Jillian in the second half hour. Right now on the phone line, though, is Ian Schur, a senior editor at CNET.com. Ian, welcome back to the Biz Lunch.
Hi, how you doing?
I'm doing well, thanks. Okay, so I've got a group that we're going to Switzerland in a couple of weeks, and I was sent a bunch of menu choices to make for the group, and I really hate doing it because I don't know what this restaurant is known for or that restaurant is known for. That's kind of an extreme case, but I see now that Google Maps is out with a new app just today that will allow you, when you go into a restaurant, to, in a way, get recommendations, right, or to find out what the restaurant sells the most?
Well, yeah, so it's going to be interesting. This idea of Google Maps has a bunch of contributors, you may not know, who actually help it identify new restaurants or even take photos inside of restaurants. People who are just excited about doing this, right? It's kind of the same as the top Yelpers, right? And the people who write restaurant reviews for free. So what's going to happen now is that the dishes and the kind of names of things that people tend to write the most to Google about in these reviews that they give it will now become the things that it kind of suggests to you. It says, hey, a lot of people talk about the chicken curry. A lot of people talk about the, you know, the milk chocolate. You should try these things. So, you know, it's going to be interesting. We have a good example on CNET of what it looks like when you see this. And it kind of looks like a menu of the top hits. But, you know, as someone who likes to try new restaurants and is always curious what everyone likes, and my first question to any server is, what's the best thing on the menu?
Right.
This will be really helpful.
And they tell you what their best profit margin is on the menu.
Yes, they always do,
but,
yes.
But so I would value
that.
Right, I ask, too. And it's terrible because then I don't get it. How much information is there? And I guess my question is, how big is the pool of contributors? Because if it's just one person who really likes chicken curry recommending chicken curry, that's not going to help me very much.
It's true. And, you know, as it is with all what we like to call user-generated reviews, you have to take it with a grain of salt, if you will.
Thank you.
These things are created by people who are enthusiasts. And so as a result, they are going to be a little different from you. This is a large community of people, though. You know, Google has a bunch of people who contribute, as does Yelp and everyone else. So I imagine that over time, this is going to get curated in a way that will be helpful. But it does not resolve for stuff like maybe you have different tastes from people, right? Or also maybe the restaurant changes hands and the quality changes and stuff like that. So you always have to be a little careful, but they hope it'll be helpful.
So it seems to me that this is a sign or another indication of Google Maps trying to be more than a map piece of software, a map app, if you will.
Oh, it's actually, I would go a step further and say this is Google trying to be more than it is, right? One of the conversations about Google in the last few years is how it tries to be everything for you. And I mean, when you type in something like you want to learn about the White House, it doesn't just give you a link to the White House and then a link to the White House Wikipedia page and some news. It actually has on the right side information about the White House, so you never have to leave Google to learn about it. If you type in information on a movie, it's actually going to give you movie times. It doesn't send you to Fandango or other stuff. You could click those links, but you don't have to. So increasingly, Google just wants to be giving you all the information you need immediately versus having to make you click.
I want to ask you about the cashless stores because we've got an Amazon Go store. We have kind of a pedway here, Ian, so I can get to it by walking underground. And I know they announced, I think it was in April, that they're going to start taking cash. Philadelphia said you can't have a cashless store. It's interesting to me because, in a way, they're creating laws to hold back progress, I think. I understand that if people are not, quote-unquote, bankable, I think it is, 8.3 million, I thought the number was, that people who don't have plastic or bank accounts at all, you know, would be prohibited from these stores. It seems to me that rather than ban cashless stores, we should find ways to get plastic into the hands of those who don't. And when I say plastic, I don't mean credit cards necessarily, right? But in there was an article on CNET where there are a few places where they're doing that, where they're trying to figure out a way to get around this cashless ban.
Yeah, and I think it's interesting to see what's going to happen. There's definitely more and more cities and states coming down on cashless stores. San Francisco, New York, Washington, D.C., they're all starting to crack down on this. And I can understand the reason why. You mentioned 8.4 million households that are unbanked. And that, by the way, is from the FDIC. That means households. That's right. Like, you know, three or four people in each household. See, this quickly balloons to tens of millions of people. But what I think what's interesting here is that, you know, this is also a conversation about progress, as you mentioned. And I am one of those people who wants to ditch their wallet as soon as I can. And I was really excited when Apple started doing their thing and Samsung started doing their thing. But there's an argument to be made that forcing people to use Visa and MasterCard, who make a percentage off of every purchase we make, is forcing people into a situation that may be not fair. So the other thing also I want to throw out there is that cash is anonymous. And some people don't like the idea of being tracked on right. everything they do. And that's another issue that we have to respect as we're thinking about this, because we've been doing cash for over 100 years now.
So, but there was a stadium that was written about in the article, I think it might have been in Atlanta, where you can go and put your cash into a kiosk, and they will send you back a debit card with no charges or anything like that, not trackable, and then you could yep. go use that at the souvenir stand. Is that a solution, or... I don't know, maybe I mean, because, you know, I'm also leery of government telling businesses how to run their businesses, saying you have to take dollar totally. Bills, because businesses lose money with cash.
Well, and that's and it's a tough proposition. They also lose money with credit cards.
Well, they have to pay money. Yeah, right. It's not stolen from them.
Right. So but I think what's going to be interesting is that this is starting a conversation that, by the way, is going around the world. In other countries, they have these cards that have been created by the government. In Hong Kong, for example, there's one called the Octopus Card, where you put money on it, you can use it for mass transit, you can use it to pay for things. It's basically your cash. And I think that over time, that's probably where we're headed. But I think we do have to deal with these questions about surveillance, especially as countries like China and everything start really upping their surveillance of citizens. And it raises questions for us in the United States about how much comfortable
But you're talking about how you love to use Apple Pay, but you're also worried about surveillance. So, I mean, it sounds like you're dancing with both. But you're dancing with both partners, Carter.
You're right. You're absolutely correct. And look, this is a challenge that everyone has. And some people are not using Apple. I have friends who refuse to use these new technologies because they don't want to be tracked. And look, those are probably a small percentage of the population.
Right.
But we as a society have to decide what we want in the future. Do we want something where if the government wanted to, it could dig into every purchase I make? Some people may not be comfortable with that.
And so we can go to Walmart or Target now and give cash to them, and they will give us a debit card so we can go home and order online from Target or Walmart.
Look, this is not easy, and I'm really curious to see what happens. For the record, by the way, credit card companies as well are trying to come up with ways to create unique identifiers and ways to disintermediate your information from the purchases you make. So everyone is kind of hip to this problem. I have a feeling in 10 years it'll all be solved. But in the meantime, it's a little messy, and we're seeing governments try to push back in an effort to at least protect these people who, as we mentioned, are unbanked.
Well, listen, I don't want to freak you out, but I know where you are every Thursday at 12:15. And I'm glad you're here.
Yes, I'm glad to be here, too. Thank you.
Ian Schur is the senior editor at CNET.com. It's 12:22. You're listening to the Wintrust Business Lunch here on 720 WGN, sponsored by Wintrust Chicago's Bank. Our regular conversations with Bill Geiger are sponsored by Geiger Wealth Management, Chicago's retirement planning experts. Bill, welcome back to the Biz Lunch.
Good to be here, sir. Thank you.
So we've been talking around this for a few weeks, I think, now, but tell me about a retirement plan and the value of it, why it's important to create an actual plan.
Steve, creating a plan for yourself gives you a wonderful amount of confidence. If you know how much money you'll need to retire, if you know when you can retire, and if you know how much income you'll have to pay your bills when you retire, you can really spend the rest of your working years confidently building a great retirement.
So how soon can you do it? I mean, how far in advance can you predict what you're going to need and things like that?
Steve, the short answer is you start as soon as possible, maybe 5 to 10 years before retirement. When you start can actually make a really, really big difference in how well you live for the rest of your life. I'll tell you a story. We had a 55-year-old couple in our office that wanted to put $500,000 away to create income for their retirement.
Mm-hmm.
55.
So they're away from retirement. They've got
10 years out.
They got a chunk.
Yeah.
And they're going to say, we're going to use this chunk to start a retirement plan.
Yeah. So we did some illustrations for them. And if they waited till they're 65 to put that $500,000 to work, they'd get about $28,000 a year from that.
Okay.
If they started 5 years before they retired, they're going to get about $35,000. But get this, if they started at 55, by the time they're ready to retire, they'll have over $60,000 a year. That's a 12% cash flow for the rest of their life.
Wow. Okay.
It really, really pays to start early.
And so what we're talking about then is you're putting the money in vehicles where it's more protected. It's creating income,
yeah,
but more protected.
It's protected.
I mean, so we could leave it in the stock market and it might grow more, but it might...
and it might grow less or it might go down.
Right, right, right.
But in the income strategy, the longer it's there, the more power, it's like Social Security. The longer you wait for Social Security, the bigger it is, right?
What do you get?
Same thing with the income strategies you use. So it really pays to have a plan, and it really pays to start as soon as possible, at least 5 to 10 years out from retirement.
So, you know, I hadn't thought of that before where you're not taking everything. You're taking part of what you've saved. Explain how often, is that the way it's usually done?
Well, you think about the old days. The older you got, the more you took out of stocks, and the more you put toward bonds, right?
Right, right, right.
And we did that because we were going to build up our income for retirement. Well, bonds don't work as well anymore, but there are still income strategies that work the same way as that. So the older you get, the more you put toward it. But this couple, this 500, was about half of their portfolio.
And we've talked about this before. There's no better feeling than knowing that it's almost like living the retirement lifestyle while you're still working.
Yeah.
If you know that you're there.
Well, this couple, when we put
right,
that,
you know what I mean? You know,
yeah. We put that 500 in. They know they're getting over $60,000. That's like knowing you have a $60,000 pension. How much could you relax and enjoy the last 10 years of your work,
right,
if you knew you had a $60,000 pension?
Is it is there a time that's too early to start? I mean, if you've got the nest egg saved?
Generally, we don't have money.
The nest egg isn't there.
Nest egg's not there until you're in your mid to late 50s. Right.
So when you sit down to come up with a plan, what are the sorts of things you look at, and how long does it take to do it?
Well, it doesn't take that long. We meet two or three times to do this, and we prepare a plan for folks. And what was the other part of the question?
Well, I mean, what are the sorts of things you look at when you're putting it together?
How much money they're going to need.
Right.
Really? I mean, you got your Social Security coming in. You know what it costs to keep your lifestyle. There's a gap there. How much do you need? And really, having more income coming in than what you need is utopia, right?
So that's one of the interesting things to me is that, because I think, oh my God, how am I going to figure out how much I need? You know, because I don't really know how to do that.
Set yourself up for more.
Yeah.
Set yourself up for more. I've been doing this for 35 years, Steve. Never had anybody come in say they had too much income. Never, never,
no,
never.
No, it's never happened?
Never. Hey, listen, we're talking about preparing a plan for retirement. We're going to offer the next 5 callers to come in a complimentary plan, full-blown plan. It's a $3,000 value. We'll put it together for them on a complimentary basis. They have to have $500,000 in their portfolio and be one of the first 5 callers.
Bill Geiger, great to see you again. I appreciate
you
coming in.
Good to see you,
sir. Thanks very much, Eric Rung. Steve Bertrand here. It is the Wintrust Business Lunch on 720 WGN, sponsored by Wintrust Chicago's Bank. All right, we're always talking about college education, the importance of it, and of course the cost of it, and how entire generations are buried in college loan debt. While there's a growing movement to have students actually earn college credits while they're still in high school, it's something that Jillian Berman has had her eye on from MarketWatch.com. She joins us on a phone line now. Jillian, welcome back to the Business Lunch.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, so, you know, I know that this is referred to as dual enrollment, the idea that you're in high school but earning college credits too. Is this the same thing as advanced placement classes?
So this is different from advanced placement classes. There's a couple of big differences. One is that dual enrollment courses are, you know, the students are either sitting in a community college classroom, so they're actually taking the classes on campus, or it's a, you know, it's taught by a high school teacher in their high school with a college syllabus, and you get a grade at the end of the course, and whether you get credit is determined by that grade. It's not like with AP where you have to, you know, just score a certain number on the test. To find out whether you get credit. Yeah.
I get that. So if you're taking an AP test at the end of that course, our AP course, at the end of that course, you take a test, you have to get a certain score, and then you get the credit. Here, it's an actual college class, and if you get come out with a B, you come out with a B for your GPA.
Right. Yeah, I mean, it's sort of the process by which the credits transfer varies, and the grade that might be on your college transcript varies, but typically, if colleges accept these credits from high school students, if you have at least a C, then they'll transfer over. So it's not just based on that one test. They're actually college courses as opposed to AP, which is, you know, those are courses designed for high school students. There's a couple of differences there.
Okay, so the idea then, I guess, would be that you can take college courses early, get them out of the way, and then not have to borrow money to take those courses later, right?
Yeah, so that's a big motivator for the expansion of these courses.
And is that what happens?
So the picture is more complicated, and that's kind of what I looked at in this group of stories. Basically, you know, the students are taking these courses at community colleges in their local community, and depending on the universities that they decide to go to full time, whether or not those schools take the credits varies. So students may spend time in high school taking these courses, and then when they go on to college, the college may not take the credits, or they might take them, but it doesn't count really towards their major, so it's just kind of like extra elective credits. So it doesn't really save them time and money.
I would think, too, that a lot of students who go in, and I'm more familiar with people getting AP credits, but that doesn't necessarily translate into fewer classes. And if it's not fewer classes, it's not fewer dollars in tuition. They just spend the money on taking another class, another elective, or things like that.
Right, exactly, yeah.
This was a big thing for Mayor Emanuel, right? The outgoing mayor of the city of Chicago, he worked hard on this sort of program in Chicago. You wrote about that?
Yeah, so for this group of stories, I visited Chicago and actually some of the northwest suburbs as well, which are both places that have really been ramping up these courses. And so, yeah, in Chicago, Mayor Emanuel really, kind of as part of a broader plan to prepare high school students for life beyond high school, was really ramped up the number of students in Chicago public schools taking these courses.
Is it too early to know? I mean, is his program been a success, or we just have to wait to see the results?
Yeah, you mean in Chicago specifically?
In Chicago specifically, yeah.
Yeah. So it's, I think it's been a success in the sense, if you measure just by the number of students taking the courses or graduating with one of these courses on their transcript,
right,
the numbers really have increased. So in that sense, it's been a success. They hope to do research on whether students are getting, some kind of cost saving, so that we don't know yet. It is one problem with these programs across the country is that in a lot of cases, they're not spread equally. So, in Chicago, it has provided opportunities for students that might not have had them before.
But it also costs the districts, right? I was surprised to read that. I think it was in Texas that they spent, was it over $100 million on one of these programs one year?
Yeah, so depending on how the different localities structure the programs, they do cost money. So in some cases, in some places, students do actually pay tuition to take these courses, but that is relatively rare. So usually, often students are taking them for free. And obviously, if they're taking them for free, somebody is paying for them. And so in Chicago, actually the institution that is sort of has the biggest cost burden, and it was a little more than $1 million, I think, is City Colleges, which is where the students take the courses. But yeah, there is obviously a cost to it.
So in the Chicago program, they're taking it not so much in their own high school, but they'll go to a City College and take the college class there.
Right, yeah. So they'll take the college class there, or, in some cases, they'll have a teacher in the high school who has the credentials that they could be, basically an adjunct at the community college, and they're teaching from a college syllabus.
Okay, so that's the situation in the city. Tell me what you found in the Northwest suburbs.
Yeah, so they also have ramped up offering these courses over the past several years. I visited District 214, and there, they've really started to think about, okay, how do we not just evaluate students based on how they're doing on their tests junior year, but whether, they can graduate and eventually return to the community with a job that affords them a life to raise a family there. And so as part of that, they've expanded these programs, and they've really, they want students to start thinking about their career pathways relatively early on. And so they'll, these classes can kind of help with that, introduce students to a college level, say like biology course, if they want to be a doctor or something like that.
I like the notion, too, that the idea of taking these college courses in high school sometimes will help a student realize that she is qualified for college or he's qualified for college. I mean, you might grow up thinking that you're not smart enough to do that. If you get to tackle it in a relatively friendly environment, I would imagine it gives the kids some confidence that they can go on and succeed.
Yeah, and that's definitely, that's a pretty, I would say, proven benefit of these kinds of programs. The kind of money question is still, there's not much research on that, and that's still, really hanging out there as to whether it works, but it does appear to, make it more likely that students will attend and persist in college if they've sort of had this experience of doing it before.
It's kind of funny to me that it's like, well, we think we have a solution, so we're going to continue to expand what we think might be the solution, but in the end, we really don't know if it's the solution.
Yeah, exactly. So, as I was just saying, these courses do have benefits, right? So, people will, educators always say if the opportunity is available for them to take rigorous courses, they should be taking advantage of it. And so more rigorous courses is better. It helps just, to help them learn and also to get into college. So there are benefits, but the question of whether it really saves time and money is still, we don't know yet.
When do you think we know? I mean, I would imagine this is going to continue to expand, right?
Yeah, so it's going to continue to expand. And I think, researchers are, are zeroing in on that specific question a little more. There's definitely been some research on sort of the question that we talked about before, how it helps students perform in college. Now they're really digging into a little bit more what are the most effective ways to offer these courses, and then also the affordability question, because it's only in the past maybe 10 years or so that the courses have really been emphasized as a money-saving thing, as people have gotten more concerned about college costs. In the past, they were touted as having thought about their benefits.
Right, and so this really, if it works, it would give everyone a leg up, but it would, in particular, I would imagine, give the economically disadvantaged a bit of a leg up, right? That's the hope here.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, students and families who have trouble affording college, they don't have as much room to, unfortunately, to switch majors and things like that because it can be really costly. So if you come into, the college with 2 years of credits under your belt, you might have the opportunity to, pursue one major, and then maybe if you discover that's not working for you, you can switch and not really have to worry so much about the cost.
Jillian Berman writes about this at MarketWatch.com. It's a 6-part series. Jillian, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
It's the Wintrust Business Lunch on 720 WGN.
Start the timer, because here's the Wintrust Business Minute. Sharing and examining Chicago business news of the day. Lists and surveys are pretty popular online these days. Thank you, BuzzFeed.
Oh my god, I love BuzzFeed!
One of the more important lists came out detailing the J.D. Power Consumer Satisfaction Survey for traditional airlines. Alaska Airlines took the top spot, and unfortunately, Chicago's United is at the bottom of the list. To be fair, though, airlines go through the gauntlet these days if a negative story emerges, and it can completely flip the consumer's perception in a single day if it's bad enough. So the business side is pretty volatile, and the J.D. Power consumer surveys are important, but take it with a grain of salt.
I thought we were talking about BuzzFeed.
All right, millennial, how about esports?
What?
Chicago-based Peak Six Investments just bought the esports team out of Seattle called Evil Geniuses. The esports industry is estimated to be worth $138 billion, so dipping their toes into the big old digital pool, pretty good idea.
I'm sorry, were you still talking?
Oh, yeah. You're still on your phone. Okay. I'm Bennett Wakenight, and that's your Wintrust Business Minute.
Thanks very much, Orion Samuelson. Steve Bertrand here. It is the Wintrust Business Lunch on 720 WGN, sponsored by Wintrust, Chicago's bank. You know, one of the things, Orion, is today they set the record, right, for the amount of moisture in the Chicago area in May, the wettest May ever, followed only by last year. And that I think before that it was 1945 or so. But Orion's talked a lot about the fact that, you know, they just can't get the crops in the field. And I see in Cranes, the headline, weather chaos expected to leave record corn acres unplanted. Amy Guth is here, the host of the Daily Gist from Cranes. So we're going to drive by a lot of mud this 4th of July when we go on our drive.
Yeah, this is a really tough story for farmers, you know, thinking about that predicament, because crop insurance is really considered a last-ditch effort because you only get about half of what you would make from that crop. So it's really not the ideal thing, but it seems like a record number of claims to be made this year, estimating about 6 million acres. So in 2013, it was 3.6 million acres.
Wow.
That were left unplanted. 6 million acres is a lot.
Yeah.
And Illinois, Indiana, Ohio are going to be the hardest hit, as well as kind of that edge between like the Dakotas and right through there, so and through Iowa. So that's a big swath of land, just because of rainfall in the Midwest is just really, it's, I mean, the fields are just not usable.
You deal with that, and then you deal with the Chinese tariffs and things like that. The government says it's going to offer some assistance, I think $16 billion, but it could be a long summer for America's farmers.
Yeah, it remains to be seen. I mean, that could still shift. The last date of planting for that insurance deadline,
right,
is not upon us just yet, so it remains to be seen. But it's really looking that way, like it's just going to be a very soggy summer.
Speaking of deadlines, the state legislature is facing a deadline of tomorrow, right? The state legislature is supposed to adjourn by the end of the month. Here we are at the 30th. I think there's 31 days in May. And, well, they got to do a lot of voting.
You know, it's always interesting to see at the end of the month how things are like, oh, yeah, we got to do this. It's like a funny procrastination coming out of Springfield, suddenly going like, oh, yeah, this. So there's a lot going on with sports betting. That's something we've talked about before here on the show. But, you know, just yesterday, suddenly the pot bill picked up a lot of steam. And it went from about 500-something pages to 610 pages.
And it was introduced yesterday morning.
Yeah.
And then the Senate.
Suddenly, very fast.
And the Senate voted on it last night. And so they've approved it. It's before the House now. So I don't know that Speaker Madigan has really said what he thinks is going to happen here.
Yeah.
Governor seems pretty optimistic.
The governor seems very optimistic and has really kind of made a call to the House and really praised the Senate for the work yesterday. Pritzker was saying, you know, Illinois is poised to become the first state in the nation that put equity and criminal justice reform at the heart of its approach to legalizing cannabis. And I'm grateful that the Senate has taken this important step with this bipartisan vote. I mean, really lavishing all this praise,
right,
really encouraging the House to go. But, you know, yesterday I was talking with John Pletz a little bit on the Daily Gist about this story. And what's really interesting is this has been a really unique approach, and ours is the first to work so far.
You
right?
mean to do it with the criminal justice reform or the...
To do it this way, with this approach as a bill, as opposed to, you know, putting it as a referendum before voters. We've done it in a really unique way. So far it hasn't really worked out for other states. And so if it does end up working out for us, we're going to be setting a lot of precedent.
What hasn't worked out for the other states?
Well, I think because it's so thorny, because there's so many issues, that expunging records part is really tricky, because there you have the intersection of emotional stuff, because you're talking about someone's loved one, you're talking about someone's life.
You're talking about victims.
Yeah, yeah, right. I mean, you're talking about a lot of stuff. You're talking about people who are incarcerated, who would have their records expunged. And as John Pletz pointed out yesterday, the criminal justice system is one that is designed, even though they've automated a great deal of the record expungement process at this point, it's still designed to move very slowly. So there's a lot of emotions that can get caught up in that. And that's one of the big ones. Also, home growing is a big issue that was amended a little bit to just being for medicinal use. And then there's a big conversation, I think, that will continue with law enforcement, talking about how that falls under DUI rules.
Right. They got to figure out how to measure that.
Yeah.
So that's the pot one. The gaming one, the governor said he's feeling pretty good about. You know, it looked like last week or so that marijuana might have been the one most on the edge.
Yeah, it seemed that way.
And that sports gambling was going to sail through. We haven't got a vote in either chamber yet, I don't believe. With sports gambling.
And that's one, it seems like there's a little bit less, it seems like the people have a pulse less on that one.
Right.
A week ago, it seemed like a slam dunk almost, and it seemed really positive and very optimistic. It seems real quiet right now, so that seems kind of curious. But the marijuana one seems like a lot of optimism. Even people that have been opposed at this point are like, you know, we're not excited, but we're no longer opposed.
Well, maybe they're holding it back too as leverage to get the votes on marijuana and things like that. Governor still has an infrastructure plan that he's hoping for.
He's got lots of plans he's still hoping for. He's very optimistic about this here in this last week. It sounds like he's really like cheering everybody, like, hey, everybody, let's go do this in these final hours. So it's going to be interesting to see what the next 24 hours happens.
Hey, wait a minute. There's a state budget that needs to be approved.
Oh, that.
Have we looked at the budget at all?
That's right. I forgot that thing.
That hasn't gotten any play at all. Amy Guth. Sort all this out for us in the Daily Gist today, will you?
I sure will. I'll get right on that.
Check out the Daily Gist, the podcast from Crane's Chicago Business. You can find it at WGNRadio.com every afternoon or just subscribe. We'll talk again soon. This is the Wintrust Business Lunch on 720 WGN.